Welcome back. This is episode 6 of Killing Time, the podcast, the Jennifer Farber Dulow story, Murder in the Morning. Nearly 2 years after Jennifer disappeared and was officially declared a homicide victim by the state of Connecticut, the search for her remains continues. Pamela K. Brown and Cynthia Fagan return to Waveney Park in New Canaan, where Jennifer Farber Dulow is not forgotten. And people are still asking, where's Jennifer?
We drove to a small gravel turnout at Waveney Park. This is where police believe Fotis transferred Jennifer's body from her SUV to a borrowed red Toyota pickup truck in broad daylight. It's still chilling to think about this is where it all began.
We're back here, literally, at the staging area where Fotis parked his vehicles at the edge of Waveney Park, standing in a turnout on Lapham Road where Fotis parked that red truck on that day. It sure looks different than the last time we were here.
Well, we were there. We were here in December, and now we're in the springtime, almost near the second anniversary of Jennifer's murder.
Which is just days away.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there's a lot more foliage and overgrowth, and quite interesting. There's just like a trodden path that goes from the turnout here straight into the woods. So he could have just dragged Jennifer's body out. No one would have seen anything. And 15 feet, 20 feet away, he would have been hidden by all the brush. We just walked over to a makeshift memorial for Jennifer right at the entrance of the park. And beautiful blue, painted blue stones. And it's written, Justice for Jennifer.
And this is just one of several hand-painted stones, some of them larger than others. This one has ladybugs on it, and it's, you know, handwritten. Clearly someone put a lot of effort to paint this one, but just down on the front part of the park, Cynthia, there's even a much bigger makeshift memorial. And I say that makeshift, it's got some plastic flowers, it's got some bracelets that say Justice for Jennifer, and something that says Jennifer's Law, which
yes.
is why it's another part of the story that is current and very vitally important to a lot of people in Connecticut.
It's not the conclusion. In a way, it's the beginning, where the state of Connecticut is working to improve laws that are protect partners or spouses from violence,
yeah.
abuse.
And intimate violence.
While walking around, we met a local mom who still thinks about the crime and the victim.
I'm Meg. I'm a mom of two middle school-age girls.
Meg, you're aware of the Jennifer Farber Dulow story and what happened to her. You see the makeshift memorial down by the entrance of the park. What do you think? What are you thinking of when you see that memorial and see the rocks?
I just feel so badly that this happened to a mom in town and to her poor children who are left to live with an elderly grandmother, and how awful that the system couldn't protect her.
And it's still stunning. One person told us she may never be found. Do you think that's possible, or do you think she's out there and she will be found?
Anything is possible. You know, they find bodies 30 years on. I hope it's not that long, but yeah, there is always the chance that she's somewhere. It still makes me tear up just thinking about this woman that has lost her life to domestic violence and for her family.
But the sad reality is Jennifer's murder by a violent partner captured the headlines because of her wealth and social status. There are thousands of underreported acts of intimate partner violence against women in high conflict divorces. They never make the front pages. A lot of them are in Connecticut.
Okay, Betsy Keller, and I'm the founder of Connecticut Protective Moms. I am in Connecticut, so I understand the doings and undoings of Connecticut Family Court and the harmful family practices that lead to mothers and children being put in danger or being put in very traumatic emotional situations, in addition to physical danger. This is the hundreds of mothers I've spoken to in the state who are in the family court system.
How many are in your organization right now?
We have about 150 moms that we are working with. And I started realizing that we need a unified voice to rectify the harmful practices in family court because no one was listening.
Who's at fault here? The system, the amount of money made in a divorce?
Okay. You have to understand, there's nothing wrong with paying your lawyer. He's providing you with service. You want protection, especially if you're a domestic abuse victim. You want to hire someone you trust and can be aggressive. They talk about the quote-unquote pit bull lawyer. Well, yeah, everyone wants the pit bull lawyer. There are a few of them. But the problem is they know, I believe they know, that there are so many loopholes in the system and there are so many problems within the system that they can escalate the conflict to the point where it churns legal abuse syndrome, and that's they call it paper abuse, where every time you go to court and you file a motion, that means I would like to take Susie on vacation next week. I need her passport. That's a motion. You have to, if your spouse doesn't agree to give you the passport or even let you travel, you end up in the court.
Betsy Keller says to date she has spent a whopping $2 million in her own legal fees over a 10-year period. And get this, incredibly, she's still not divorced. Now, she is spearheading state legislation to change all that. It's known as Jennifer's Law, plural Jennifer's, to represent not only Jennifer Farber Doulos, but all who have suffered intimate partner violence.
Jennifer's Law is a culmination of years and years of protective mothers, mothers who are domestic violence victims trying to protect their children, seeking safety in a courtroom, in a family courtroom, in a separation, whether you have a partner or it's the father or mother of your children, and seeking safety in a family courtroom when they finally get the courage to leave. Through the years, and most notably in my years in family court as a litigant in a divorce case in Connecticut, I've been in court for 10 years, so I've seen a lot. I've been in a lot of hearings and trials. I've met a lot of mothers seeking that safety in the courtroom.
Messy divorce is a huge business in Connecticut. We spoke with family attorney Nicola Cunha, who has represented scores of clients who span the economic spectrum.
And if you have a lot of plead-ins, then it on its face, the appearance is that, boy, something really bad is going on. There's a lot of conflict here. It's extremely expensive, and it's, you know, usually the term is cost prohibitive. So the more you file, the more money you make as an attorney. And the more you file, the more time you're in court. You could be there all day. And you could be there with one client, or you can be there with five clients, typically, which is another area of contention for me, because I think that if you're going to charge somebody hundreds of dollars an hour, personally, I would want my attorney to be focusing on my case. I understand there's times where you can't avoid having multiple matters fall on the same day and you try to manage it, but it's become, or it was historically, a very typical way of generating a lot of money.
Top celebrity divorce attorney Raoul Felder says rules in divorce court are in need of a serious overhaul.
Well, you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it's surprising that the courts don't call a halt to it.
As the number one divorce attorney in America, Raoul Felder has repped Elizabeth Taylor, Johnny Carson, and Rudy Giuliani as he exited his first marriage.
I had a case. It's called you have them declared an abusive litigant, which means that they have to get the permission of the chief judge of the court to bring any kind of new motions. It's a journey. Divorce is a journey. And sometime along the road, they lose their mind. They do crazy things.
Yeah. Well, I liked what you said, Raoul. Divorce is a journey.
They lose their way, too. The most ordinary divorces, there's sometimes a skein of violence in them. And sometimes they're just diabolical people.
What do you say to a client who's clearly this unhinged, they're going through this agony, this pain, this bitter, bitter divorce, and they go, I'm going to effing kill my wife. I'm going to effing kill my husband. And you say,
get rid of them. The simplest thing is to get rid of them as quickly as possible. Tell them they need help. You can't report them because of whatever they tell you. it's privilege, so it's a problem. You just get rid of them.
Back in Connecticut, Betsy Keller says that coercive control is a dirty open secret that needs to be changed in state law. It's a different kind of cycle of abuse that many women find themselves trapped in.
I believe that the laws are in favor, very patriarchal, in favor of the father. I believe that there's ignorance about domestic violence, so they don't understand it's not current, right now, present physical danger. It's little traumatic abuses. They call them microtraumas, for years and years of being emotionally controlled, not having access to money, not having access to the keys of the car, not access to be able to take your child to a doctor to pay the copay. I mean, little things like that every day. And that even happens in Greenwich, Connecticut or New Canaan. So you have moms with the Mercedes who are driving around and they have $10 in their bank account because they're the father of their children wants to control what they do, what they buy, where they go, and they have to beg and plead for the basics. So that is abuse. That is abuse to me.
Remember, in Jennifer's case, Fotis used her family money to carry out his pattern of abuse. To begin with, he refused Jennifer's offer of joint custody of their five children. Carrie Luft. I mean, we talk about everything that Jennifer Farber Doulos did correctly, and the system still failed her.
Great question. Obviously, very complicated. We work within a legal system. The wheels of justice are very slow moving. There are fundamental problems within the system. There are fundamental problems within our society. Fotis was an obstructionist. He racked up fine after fine, contempt after contempt in court, and he never faced financial consequences for that. As I understand, he could have eventually been arrested just for his contempts of court. He did face some consequences. I want to make that very clear, that Judge Donna Heller deemed him an unfit parent and took away what had originally been a shared custody agreement after Jennifer had filed in the early months.
Farber family attorney Richard Weinstein said Fotis even told Jennifer what she could eat.
I mean, he was a controlling person. I referred to her on more than one occasion as the Stafford wife. And I actually had owners or managers of restaurants come up to me knowing of my involvement and tell me of the stories of, you know, Fotis and Jennifer having dinner in their restaurant. And when I would listen to the stories, this poor lady, what she went through, I mean, she was the Stafford wife.
Can you give us an example of what she went through?
Yeah, example was she couldn't order her own meal. He ordered for her. Example was, as she's eating the meal, he's only keeping an eye on how much she's eating because he wanted her thin as could possibly be. You could just sense it was a very uneasy relationship between Fotis and Jennifer. And this is in a restaurant.
My God.
That's horrible. Betsy Keller says she's familiar with what Jennifer was going through.
As in the case of Jennifer Doulos, she walks into the courtroom, says, I'm being coercively controlled. He's emotionally, abusing me. I don't know where the money is. He makes my children water ski 12 hours a day. I'm exaggerating. But she was under constant pressure. It's called stop walking on eggshells. You feel like you're walking on eggshells so you don't trigger the assault, the emotional assault from the abuser. So for the first time in her life, she probably told a couple friends, she went to court, she hired a lawyer, and she felt like she needed big time protection in court because this is the first time she's going to show the world what's really been happening under her roof.
To be clear, not everyone going through a divorce from hell has the big bucks. Attorney Nicola Cunha.
So I'm going to be very clear about this. I feel very strong about this. If somebody is going to do something bad, they're going to do it no matter what protections are put in place. My memory in Connecticut goes all the way back to Tracy Thurman.
In 1982, Tracy Thurman, a young mother from Torrington, Connecticut, was stabbed 13 times, stomped in the head until her neck broke, and left for dead by her estranged husband, despite a court order to stay away. He then threw the couple's infant son on his mother's broken body. The police were called to the scene, but did nothing to stop the attack, because it was considered a domestic dispute between a married couple.
anyone not being able to go for help and get the help that they were seeking. And it was really scary.
Incredibly, Tracy Thurman survived, remarried, but remains partially paralyzed. She became the first woman in America to successfully sue a town and its police department. Here she is, recently speaking on behalf of the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence.
When I'm out in the store and someone comes up to me and approaches me and says, you know, you saved my life, or you've changed my life, that is, it was all worth what I went through to hear that. It makes me feel honored that they look up to me, they could better their life. I'm very fortunate that I'm here to be able to share my story. And I also feel like I have an obligation to the people that weren't as lucky as I to be their voice for them. And it is rewarding to me to know that, God, if I could save one person from what I had gone through, this is why I do it.
A stunning story. The landmark national law passed in 1986 is known as the Thurman Law. It's the Family Violence Prevention and Response Act. It mandates that police make arrests in domestic violence cases even if the victim does not wish to press charges. Tracy Thurman was awarded $2.3 million, and she went on to remarry. Her ex-husband served 14 years in prison. I would like to think that the Thurman Law has helped police be more aware of domestic violence and that actually has saved lives.
Pam, I can't imagine any amount of money would make up for the abuse Tracy suffered. Money can't protect you either. That was clearly the case with Jennifer. If your intimate partner hates you enough to want to kill you, they will try.
Betsy Keller says today there are not enough family court judges, and the legal fees are punishing, whether you are rich or poor. For context, remember, 95% of divorce cases settle out of court. But when they don't, it's an expensive nightmare.
Called Short Calendar Monday. You would wait anywhere from 1 to 5 hours all day in court just to hear if you could possibly agree on whether you could travel to Florida or travel to the Bahamas and have a passport. So you would have spent, let's say, $1,000 an hour times five, each of you. What is that? $10,000. But the court was so ineffective in their scheduling of these short calendar days. And typically you waited all day. And then if you had a high conflict case, the 5% that returned to court, because you can't get to a negotiation point, you would wait all day on the short calendar Monday. And then you'd be scheduled for a hearing to come back in a month, let's say, and discuss whether or not you could take Susie to Florida, the Bahamas, and get her passport. But guess what? Vacation was in 2 or 3 weeks. It didn't matter. So the hearing would be scheduled after the vacation break.
Attorney Nicola Cunha says lawyers are sometimes to blame for escalating nasty divorces.
Why did they choose to file the pleadings, the claims, the way they did? Was that a true representation of what the clients wanted at that time? At the time that the complaint was filed, where they were ready to move on and live separately and, try to co-parent. And the litigation got to them, which is not uncommon. The litigation could get to anybody. It gets to attorneys, it gets to judges, it gets to garden ad litems, it gets to litigants. And the reason for that is because we do not have adequate oversight and control as to what happens in a court proceeding when it comes to family. Many lawyers will not even practice in family law, and they'll refer to the family court as a kangaroo court.
Raoul Felder, who once had an aggrieved spouse order a hit on him, sums it up this way.
The veneer of civilization is very thin in human beings, and the long divorce, the worse it gets. Why aren't there more murders rather than less murders? And I'll tell you why. When there's a divorce going on, and the spouse, usually the wife, dies or dies under suspicious circumstances, or falls out of a window, like in one of my cases, the first person they look to, they said the first thing they ask, is she going through a divorce? What about her love life? And so then the first suspect becomes the murderer. So it's very hard to get a professional murderer to do the job.
But did Fotis commit murder in the morning with a little help from his friends? Carrie Luft.
I mean, for sure. There are many different aspects of the investigation that are ongoing. You know, namely finding Jennifer is the largest priority, but also just piecing together the events of May 24th and before it. You know, what was the planning? What was the conspiracy? And obviously, there are two people who've been charged with conspiracy to murder and who have yet to stand trial.
How are you and the Farber family holding up at this time? We're approaching this two-year anniversary of Jennifer's disappearance.
Well, thank you for asking. It's definitely complicated to answer that. Everybody is healthy and well, for which we're incredibly grateful. The kids are doing better than I think anybody could possibly expect, given what they've been through.
Even in death, Fotis made life difficult for his children. We asked Farber family attorney Richard Weinstein if anything was left for the five kids, since their names were not mentioned in Fotis's suicide note.
I guess there were five gold coins or something left for the children. Just trying to get a sense of what he did leave for his children. He didn't leave their names on his note.
There were more than five coins. There were many coins. And there arguably were watches, and there were crosses and perhaps a few other items that we believe were intended to be left for the children. I think I sent them by messenger to Gloria because I was very fearful of, God forbid, they got lost. So I sent those to Gloria, and I believe she has put them in safekeeping for the children. I understand, and again, I'm not really familiar with this, but I understand part of Greek christening tradition includes giving things like gold coins. So those were in a safe deposit box, a second box that we weren't aware of at first.
Richard, did he leave a will?
To the best of my knowledge, there is no will. The affairs of the estate were very much left up in the air. There's a fidelity account, which he had, which was in effect a retirement account from the Ford Group. He took out a substantial loan from that account to give that to Pattis as part of the retainer. And there still was a balance, less than $200,000, that hopefully will go to the estate, although if I really had my wish, it would go to the children and not to the estate, because the estate is just creditors, and there will be no money for distribution, unfortunately. But even there, he did not have it properly updated to indicate who the successor would be after Jennifer as a beneficiary. And presumably he would have wanted his children to receive what the balance was, but the way it'll end up going is probably to his estate.
It did go to the estate and not the kids.
During our reporting, we got a tip that the police were back at 80 Mountain Spring Road, presumably looking for Jennifer. Okay, it's 4:20 p.m. on March 10th.
10th.
And where did we just go to, Cynthia?
Well, we went to 80 Mountain Spring Road, Pam, which is what we call the point where we believe Fotis operated out of on the day that he murdered Jennifer. Now, why are we up there now, Pam? Because?
Well, there was some chatter.
We got a tip.
I got a tip, but it could be just circular reporting and chatter. But there seems to be activity on the property.
And that the sort of social media platforms were buzzing with the fact that the claim that police had found Jennifer's body,
Remains.
Remains.
was we just didn't want to take a chance and not go.
And there was no police activity, but there was a construction type guy.
Right.
And who we know, for all we know, the property is just being prepped for its new owner.
The new owner. The mansion recently sold for $1.5 million.
The property is immense, but it remains the target of the investigation because Fotis, after he left New Canaan with his wife's body in the truck that he had borrowed from his employee, he went here. Cynthia, I want to discuss our nagging questions that still remain about the murder of Jennifer Farber-Doulos. Number one, I'm still bothered that not enough search was done at the staging house. Bob the Bone Finder told us, Cynthia, that he only spent a few hours there after the family requested him.
Yeah, but to be fair, the house was about to be sold, Pam.
Yeah. And number two, as Ken Gray, the ex-FBI agent, told us, Fotis put himself in considerable jeopardy on that day of being discovered during his day-long murder and cover-up spree. And I still wonder why Jennifer's clothing was dumped separately. That was so much work to do in one day.
By removing and getting rid of Jennifer's clothing separately, it could make it more difficult to identify the body if she's ever found, Pam. Well, number three, what's nagging me about that day is that Jennifer's suburban SUV was caught on a neighbor's security camera arriving at her Wells Lane home around 8:05 and then seen exiting around 10:25.
Yeah, Jennifer drove in and Fotis drove out with Jennifer's body inside her own vehicle.
That's the bloody vehicle he ditched at the turnout in Waveney Park when he moved her body into the borrowed red Toyota pickup truck. But how did he get into the garage without being detected?
That's a good point. But, you know, Cynthia, from my general observation, most people think they are safe when they hit a remote control button to drive into their garage. They're not paying attention, and those garage doors open slowly. It's noisy, and they're very slow to open, and they're slow to close. So, and my thought is that maybe Fotis quickly slipped in as the garage door opened when Jennifer was pulling in her massive SUV inside. And then he pounced on her with enough force that Jennifer's blood spattered against the garage walls.
Well, Jennifer may have been distracted anyway. I mean, she certainly wasn't on her guard in her own garage. Number four, and what is really nagging me, is if Jennifer was still alive, however briefly, when he drove away with her. He may have used those zip ties, which were found by the police, as handcuffs to immobilize her. I hate to think of her last terrifying moments, and I'd like to think she put up a fierce fight.
I hope so, too. Number five, Cynthia, my final nagging question is about getting rid of a body, which is so hard to do. Fotis had nearly 9 hours going by that exhaustive police report we've examined between the attack in New Canaan and the dumping of Jennifer's blood evidence in Hartford. You know, but after he stripped that body, did he bury her somewhere else at a prearranged site? Was there more than one gravesite?
Well, there was one found at the gun club that the two hunters stumbled upon, and it's also where Kent Maweni was once a member.
This hole in the ground had lime in it, too.
Yeah, I mean, that was they couldn't use that one anymore. Well, there are only two people left who could allegedly answer what really happened to Jennifer, and both are going on trial soon.
Michelle Traconis and Kent Maweni. Once again, we went back to Waveney Park. The colorful makeshift memorials calling for justice for Jennifer are clearly seen near the park's entrance. And we noticed something new had been added.
But there's also another reason why we've returned, Pam, and that is
the camera. Yeah, since we were here, we noted that there was no surveillance cameras in this area, but that's changed, Cynthia, and there is a big one right in front of Waveney Park.
At the entrance of Waveney Park, Pam, there's a surveillance camera put up between the time that we were here in December and now.
Meg, that mother of two we met in the park, has followed Jennifer's story from the beginning. She is haunted by the lack of finality.
I just wish they could find her body and have the family have something to bury and understand where she ended up.
Back in New York City, five children are thriving under the tender care of their grandmother, Gloria Farber.
She is an incredible woman. She has amazing reserves of strength and resilience. She's got a great sense of humor, which certainly gets her through. And she loves her grandchildren. She has weathered this period with incredible grace and dignity and strength I can't even imagine.
Carrie Luff says it's wonderful how much the children remind her of Jennifer.
They're amazingly resilient and clearly benefited from their mother's wonderful parenting, in that they are well-adjusted young people with great sense of self and sense of compassion and perception, curiosity and honesty, and all of those qualities have benefited them incredibly well.
Cynthia, hearing from Jennifer's best friend Carrie that the children are thriving is the one bright moment in this tragic story. However, it is still so heartbreaking to realize they will face life without their mother and their father.
Thank God for their grandmother, Gloria, and the heroism of Lauren Almeida, the children's nanny. And thanks to Jennifer's friends and family who continue to push for justice. Jennifer's law was recently passed in Connecticut.
It's really a piece of landmark legislation, and other states may follow soon.
But the reality remains that 2.5 years later, Jennifer's body has not been found, despite the ongoing efforts by the Connecticut State Police to close the case.
This episode wraps up our podcast for now. The story continues. Will Fotis' mistress, Michelle Terkonis, or Fotis' lawyer pal, Kent Mawinney, reveal anything that will lead investigators to Jennifer's body? Or will what happened to Jennifer Farber-Dulos remain a terrible secret?
Pam, when it comes to murder, somebody always knows something.
Murder in the Morning, the Jennifer Farber-Dulos story, was written and produced by Pamela K. Brown and Cynthia Fagan. Recorded and edited by David Hughes. Original music by David Hughes. And I'm Steve Langford.
And one more thing, Pam. We'd like to dedicate Killing Time, the podcast, to the late, great Steve Dunleavy, a hell of a reporter.
He was a reporter's reporter.
We miss him. Cheers, Steve.
Cheers.
Killing Time, the podcast, is a 2021 production of Bang Up Productions, LLC.